Okay. We'll talk about questions and answers, enforcement, feedback. So, starting right out on the next slide, we'll begin with our phase one outreach discussion. So, EPA conducted two outreach media campaigns. The first one was for our legislative outreach campaign. The second one was the Ad Council Lead Poisoning Awareness Campaign. And we joined with HUD, the Ad Council, and the National Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning and provided a general lead poisoning prevention outreach campaign. It included TV ads, radio ads, banners. We had some really, really wonderful outreach opportunities for billboards all across the country. That was our general effort. Now, the Lead Safe Certified outreach campaign focused simply and only on RRP outreach. We had our phase one efforts targeted training providers, consumers, and contractors, as I mentioned before. So initially, we started out with emails. You can go to the next slide. Emails and letters. The next slide. Okay. Emails, letters, webinars, speaking engagement opportunities, and website updates. But for the consumers, we developed a PSA, a public service announcement, print ad, and we were able to place the ads in magazines across the country, and some of the ones, the more popular ones, Family Fun, Parenting, Parent Magazine. So these were subscription magazines, by the way, and reached over 6.5 million people with a media value at $2.4 million. Now, to go along with the print ad, we had radio ads because we believe that in order to reach the consumers, a lot of the consumers listen to the radio, and we developed ads in English and Spanish, and they were aired on 165 stations with nearly 7,000 airings for our English version, and 34 stations with over 1,000 airings in our for our Spanish ad. Now, the ads basically were, we'll talk about it a little bit later on, but just an overall view of that I want to provide. Okay, next slide. And we have contractors, we dealt with contractors and renovators in our phase one outreach. And the most important thing we developed right off the bat was the Lead Safe Certified logo that hopefully most of the trainers are aware exists, and this is something that's distributed to all of the certified renovators who have email addresses. And it's been downloaded by over 36% of the renovators. We also developed a website, epa.gov/getleadsafe, and this website had oh, my goodness, 463,000 hits to the website, meaning the people, hopefully contractors and other folks who are interested in our material and our information, visited that site. And we had 46,000 hits to our media download pages, which I'll share with you in a few seconds. But we had many, many downloads for some of our material that was developed, and this website is broken down according to contractors and consumers. So, and we provide information for training providers as well. So, it is really a wonderful site, and hopefully, everybody by the time we end this webinar will be familiar with it or is already familiar with it. So. You can just do a little chat, epa.gov/getleadsafe. Okay. And over on our next page, we just wanted to bring up, since this is not really part of our outreach, just wanted to mention some information for training providers, since we have a captivated audience today. There's been a few questions that have been directed to EPA about the use of the logo. So just wanted to mention today that, and the question is, can the principal instructors, either folks employed or under contract to or under an umbrella with an accredited training provider, can they independently advertise, provide training, or use the EPA, let's say, certified logo? And our answer is no. This information, we're just posting this information now because it's been a question that's sort of been burning as far as the training providers were concerned. If you're a principal instructor and you advertise, you do the training courses, and you use the logo, you can do it only under the name of the accredited training provider that you work for, okay? And training providers, if they're accredited training providers, they can inform the students that only certified firms will be given a customized logo, and it'll have their certified number right on the logo, so it's specifically for the individual firm. And they can use it on their site. The accredited training providers can use the logo on their site for marketing materials as long as it's used as a tool to guide the contractors through the firm certification process, like to explain the difference between firm certification and individual training. So just wanted to take a second to mention that since you guys are training providers. Okay, next slide. Now, the overall outreach materials, want to just share with you some of the materials that we developed through the use of a marketing firm that we hired to help us out to spread the RRP message. We developed for the consumer specifically print ads, and I mentioned that they were placed in popular consumer magazines, radio ads, and I mentioned the airings that were done for both English and Spanish. Web banners, and the radio ad, by the way, is the mailer is shown with the A-plus in the slide that you're looking at now. It's the cover for it, and it sort of goes through a little quiz thing to catch the eye of the radio producers. We developed web banners like the one that's shown with the little girl in the crib, and flyers. I'll go back a second. The flyers were, I just wanted to mention real quickly, we partnered with Home Depot, and they printed 1 million copies of our flyer and distributed in their stores across the country and all their retail stores. Okay.
Great. Can we pause just quick and see if we've got any questions coming through technically? I want to make sure that everyone's getting audio and everything. So if you have any problems with audio or with the visuals, just shoot us a question. You can also email Jane Malone, jmalone@nchh.org, if you're having any technical problems. Okay.
Next slide. Okay. Now, we also, as I mentioned, we had our outreach developed for contractors, and this was pretty exciting for us to develop the campaign using the theme that you see in the slide. And it says, you know, it's a picture of a wall. This is an actual wall. This is not a Photoshop picture that we took. And there's an actual hole that was cut out, just for your own information. And we developed the print ad for a PSA use in magazines. And we developed something called the sell sheet, a sheet that we wanted the contractors to use to educate them. And all of these materials encourage the contractors to become certified and trained. Buckslip, which you probably may not be familiar with, a buckslip is actually the little piece of information about the size of a dollar or a buck. And that could easily be put into an envelope and sent with some information, a letter, a cover letter, or something like that, which is what we use with our regional offices and the postcard as well. It's distributed to contractors. We developed three sizes for web banners placed so that If an organization had a website and they wanted to, if they could, we encourage them to use our web banner on their site. Flyers, we developed in English and Spanish using the same theme that you see there. And again, Home Depot printed 1 million copies of our flyers and distributed them throughout their stores, their 1,400 stores in the country. We developed articles. We developed a long, short, and medium articles for magazines if you wanted to place information about this RRP. We also developed a trifold brochure for apartment managers, hospitals, daycare centers, and, of course, the LedSafe certified logo that I talked about. Now, the important thing that I didn't mention was that all of this information could easily be downloaded from our site, epa.gov/getLedSafe. Remember that chat?
Great.
Okay.
So, do you want to take questions at this point or move right on?
Move right on.
Can we just stop and make again, just really reiterate, each and every one of these materials that EPA developed are living on the website and fully available for anyone to download, print, whatever.
Are they editable so if people want to slap on their contact information?
They can contact us and we can give them information about editing it.
Okay.
For that very purpose.
Great. We would love that and encourage it.
Yeah.
Help out in any way.
Could you just post that information, perhaps? Would that be possible?
Oh, okay. We can.
Yeah, maybe a little handout that says how to customize our material.
Okay. And also, I just wanted to mention the print ad is ready to be dropped right into magazines. It's in the format that can be downloaded and put right in. So it has all of the hash marks and everything necessary. Now, we were going to, next slide, and the next slide, talk about phase two outreach ideas. But right before phase two outreach ideas, I just wanted to bring up a little news flash. So wake up, okay, if you're out there. And you may or may not have heard that EPA recognized the use of the 3M lead check test kits on two additional substrates. Just last week, so this is a news flash, and it's for plaster and drywall. Now, in the past, the 3M lead check was recognized for use on wood and metal, so this is these are two new substrates, and just wanted to bring that to your attention. They do require a slightly different procedure than was used for the other version than the diagonal V-notch, but it's not that difficult. And after April 1st, the kits will be updated with instructions, and they'll be in retail stores. And it's important to mention that any previously purchased kits are still usable, but they just need to be updated with the new information on how to use them. Don't forget that we also had other recognized test kits. D-lead was used for all four substrates. And the state of Massachusetts test kits could be used for plaster and drywall, only by state-certified users, however. So that was just a little news flash. Did you want to say something else?
Just to let you know, you can get the updated instructions for the 3M lead check test kit from their website, but there's also a link from our EPA lead test kit recognition webpage. It also goes to the 3M lead check website, to where their updated instructions are for plaster and drywall.
Okay. Just wanted to bring that to your attention as a news flash. And now that we have your attention, we'd like to go on and talk about the overall strategy ideas for our phase two outreach. Now, phase one was our initial push when the rule was fresh and just out, and we wanted to make sure that we got to the training providers first, the contractors, and the consumers. And now we need to refresh our ideas, and we thought that we would try to focus on some new groups using different approaches and collaborate with children's health organizations, coordinate outreach through contractor influencers, and finally highlight enforcement actions. You can go on to the next one. So with that in mind, you know, we really haven't finalized our ideas, and we're presenting these to you in hopes that toward the end of this conversation that we're having today on this webinar, that you'll be able to share your thoughts and comments and give us an idea of feedback on what you think about it, and we can go from there. The first thing that we'd like to bring to your attention is that we're thinking about focusing on new groups for consumers, new approaches to increase the demand. And this will help you as training providers, because if we drive the consumers, they will start demanding only certified, trained contractors to work on in their homes, and schools and different opportunities will arise, hopefully, in the training arena. So we have a wonderful idea that we're thinking about, and that is to do a home improvement TV episode that will feature the RRP LedSafe work practices. And this would be something, I think, you know, if we can reach the consumers, they are TV watchers and they're radio listeners in our minds. And this is something that we have not done. There was some ads done for the general lead poisoning prevention campaign that we worked with the Ad Council on, but not a TV episode. And this would be something that also we'd have an opportunity to have a little what they call webisode.
Oh, yeah.
When I type it in, it doesn't show up in spell check, so it's like a new word. But at any rate, this is something that we really are excited about, and we'd really like to use that webisode to post on our sites and maybe other sites as well. We'd also like to think about printing, redistributing some of our marketing material, our print ads specifically and the radio ads, to the consumers. Also collaborating with large health organizations, such as HMOs, without mentioning any of the large health insurance companies, that would be another way for us to encourage them to incorporate the RRP message into their business. On to the next slide. We'd like to, another idea we have is to collaborate with children's organizations. We have within EPA, the Office of Children's Health Protection, and we'd like to use some of their contacts and ideas and information to foster partnerships with children's organizations, health organizations, and social organizations, you know, like PTA, Jack and Jill, or some of the other well-known organizations, and also work with our Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee and deal with and take in some of their suggestions and ideas on how to reach parents and children and the consumers overall as far as RRP is concerned. Okay, thanks. All right. We also, as I mentioned, want to focus on new groups using different approaches for contractors. And the big thing for us is to reach uncertified contractors. We've done outreach in phase one, but we don't feel that we haven't captured enough, not nearly enough. So we're thinking about a mass mailing to contractors. This is something that we have not done so far. And this project would be a major undertaking for us, and also to bump up our social media commitment as far as outreach for RRP is concerned. Okay.
Good.
Also, for contractors, we'd like to coordinate through influencers, contractor influencers, and we feel a big one is the city and state governments or the offices that issue permits and licensing. We'd like to collaborate with them to do some outreach with them. And, again, to partner with insurance companies and apartment owners. We feel that they're a major influencer to contractors. And to highlight enforcement actions and collaborate with the enforcement office through the use of Dove Delivery, electronically, press alerts, and fact sheets. And what a wonderful segue into our enforcement program. And this would lead us right into the next speaker, Greg Sullivan.
Great. Thank you. I think we'll go right into Greg's presentation.
Sure.
Greg, you want to start? Are you on?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Great. Well, thank you for having me. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk to the training providers. Clearly, that this is where the rubber hits the road, a very important constituency here, and I want to make sure that we try to get out our enforcement message as broadly as we can. I was going to talk a little bit about a little bit of background on legal authorities and the policies that we follow for enforcement response and penalty calculations. Not too much on that. A little bit more on enforcement sort of approach as it relates to how we implement and achieve compliance monitoring with regard to the RRP rule, and then talk a little bit about enforcement process and get into some compliance and enforcement outcomes. And I hope to do that all within about 15 minutes or so. So on my next slide is slide 20, is basically just an overview. You guys know all this stuff already, but I just wanted to make it clear that from an enforcement perspective, we are looking at those requirements that apply to the to the workers' training and certification requirements, to the firms' certification requirements, to the training providers, of course, and all of that really goes to our emphasis on RRP compliance. So as we undertake all those enforcement activities and our general program, we're always looking at that, looking at this through the RRP lens. The next slide just indicates two of our main sort of enforcement authorities that I think are critical to our ability to go down this path is our inspection authority is pretty broad under TSCA, and we use it in a variety of ways. I mean, we use it to try to not only inspect the on-site, or not only inspect for records violations, as I know some of the conversation has been, well, how much is EPA enforcing actual work practice standard violations versus mere record requirement violations? And I think that I'm going to get to a little bit more detail on that, but that the answer is we are linking those two things to the extent that we can. The inspection authority we use applies to record keeping violations, so we'll look at contractor offices and try to make sure and look at their do a records review and look at what they have for certifications in their files and all the retained records requirements, whether the retained records requirements are being met. We're also going out trying to get on job sites contemporaneously with work so we can see how the actual work practice standards are being implemented. In addition, we have information collection and a subpoena authority that we use to get information on past jobs so we can kind of get a sense of how many jobs a particular entity is undertaking, and to the extent that we can get information on future jobs, it helps us sort of continue to target our inspections and make sure that we are as efficient as we can be when we're going out trying to do on-site inspections. TSCA, next slide, TSCA authorizes a pretty high per-day violation at 37.5 inflation-adjusted amount, and also authorizes criminal fines and sanctions for knowing and willful violations. So it's probably important for some of your trainees to know that there are a lot of record-keeping requirements in this rule, but in addition to the civil penalties that my office is interested in the civil violations that we're interested in enforcing against, there's this criminal element too. So knowing and willful violations can get you in a lot more trouble than a penalty calculation from my shop. The next slide just indicates the basic tenet of all of our penalty calculations is captured in this Consolidated Enforcement Response Policy document. It's available on the website, and it basically outlines the types of violations, their relative significance, and sort of the dollar range, the dollar amounts associated with the varying significance, gravity-based portion of the penalty calculation. I do want to point out in this document, and in general, EPA enforcement policy as well, we're interested in capturing any economic benefit that's achieved by a violator, so that we can attempt to try to level the playing field. That's one of the goals of our enforcement approach, is to make sure that the non-compliers aren't getting an economic advantage against the compliers. And so when we take an action against a violation, we're trying to make sure we recapture any economic benefit that, was accrued to the non-compliant party under this policy and in practice, too. Next slide. So I sort of talked about our general policy. I mean, we're the enforcement policy that I mentioned before really talks about the case-specific issues. You've got some violations, and now you're calculating a penalty. Taking a step back, we have general program guidance that for the lead program, and for particularly RRP, is really, in my opinion, focused on trying to enforce the RRP portion of the lead regulations. So when we talk to the regions and try to develop plans for how we're going to go out and target inspections and look for enforcement actions, really we're looking for some objective criteria such as known elevated blood lead levels are a good indication of where enforcement may be an appropriate response. And again, the general gist of our program resources have been moving towards an RRP focus. So we had in previous iterations of EPA sort of enforcement guidance, we would talk more about, for example, lead disclosure law violations. It's not that we're not interested in that. I think there's still going to be some opportunities to jointly look at some of the disclosure violations outside of the RRP rule, but we're really encouraging the regions to try to kind of go with an RRP focus, and if there are other disclosure violations that are uncovered during inspections or other investigations, that those sort of be added into the case but not be the driver for our inspection approach. So the next slide kind of talks about what my boundaries are today to talking to you guys. I mean, generally, we can't get into a lot of specifics on strategies about how we're going to do our inspections and what the strategy is for targeting particular entities or groups or what have you. We don't generally talk about resources or ongoing investigations or unfiled specific enforcement actions. What we can talk about is what has been filed, because those are now public documents, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that towards the end of this these slides. But it's not, I think people have the perception, at least right now, because we've been relatively quiet on the enforcement front on this rule, that there's nothing going on. And I sort of want to dispel that myth to the extent that there's a lot going on. It's just that not a lot of it is yet ready for prime time and ready for public release. So rest assured, there should be more coming. And as was mentioned earlier, when we're working to get when cases do come in, when settlements are reached, we're working with the program office and others to try to get the word out as broadly as we can, because, of course, we want to highlight the value of getting your certification to the renovation community, and the value of that is in part identified by the fact that you'd be in compliance and you wouldn't be subject to one of these enforcement actions that EPA is putting together. So the next bullet really goes to the majority of the information that we've received to date has been tips and complaints. Tips and complaints have an upside and a downside. I mean, it's great to get information about potential noncompliance and be able to follow up on that, as you can. The problem is the volume and the lack of specificity in some of those are make it difficult. We take tips and complaints very seriously. Most regions prioritize those very highly in their workload to make sure that we're responding when we hear of an imminent and an actual violation going on. But at the same time, the lack of specificity and sometimes the lack of timeliness make those tips and complaints not as valuable as other inspection strategies might be. So it's a sort of a balance between instantly we're trying to respond to tips and complaints and trying to put together a longer-term strategy for making sure we are covering all the areas that we need to be. The next bullet talks about sort of a neutral inspection scheme idea, and this is a long-standing aspect of, I think, any kind of inspection regime that you would put together that deals with the construction industry. The Supreme Court has opined on this in years past with regard to OSHA inspections in the construction industry, and OSHA had a response to that. It didn't necessarily, it clearly couldn't have applied to the RRP rule as it wasn't around at that time, but we have taken it to heart and make sure that to the extent that we are following the proper practices, again, that OSHA has laid out and others to make sure there's no arbitrary and capricious targeting, that we have a solid basis and rationale for the targets that we select, and that there's a strong correlation between targets and responses. So that's so you're avoiding any appearance or actual capricious or arbitrary behavior on the federal government's part. But the more important point I think here is for you guys is that you know, we have lists of certified renovators. We know we basically are able to know who those folks are. But I want to assure you that we don't use those for our targeting list. And for the most part, I'll say it this way: that for when we are running into firms with violations who are certified, I'm sorry, not firms, renovators who have been trained and are certified. Those are coming as either a result of a tip and complaint for some actual work practice standard violations going on, or you know, otherwise as part of an inspection. And in those cases, you know, renovators' status certification is sort of irrelevant if they're not following the work practice standards. So it's just a coincidence in those cases. But as far as a targeting and inspection framework, the fact that folks have been certified is one of the factors that we're looking at, and in fact it kicks people off of lists often as we're developing to potential targets. So I just wanted to make that point as clearly as I could. Let's see. Next slide kind of goes a little bit more into detail about what we're looking for when we do an inspection. We're actually working internally here to get out what we hope to be an explanation of what we're looking for when we're inspecting, I guess this has been done in other programs, and it goes by the term or the phrase "what to expect when you're inspected," which is kind of funny title for me because I'm a relatively new dad and read a lot of books that sounded a lot with a title very similar to that. But we understand that for the regulated community, it's important to know what we're looking for when we're going out and inspecting and otherwise engaging with the regulated community. So clearly, there's two general types of inspections that we're doing. One is the record review inspections of the firms. So we're going to go to, you know, the file cabinet and be looking for certifications, all the certifications that they have. We can cross-check that with the EPA database, make sure that their documentation is in compliance with the rule, that, you know, and that they certified that information was distributed, that there's the training certifications are present, that work practice standards were met, that verification requirements were met, and all of that can be done in the records review, records inspection context. But there is this crosswalk between the records inspection and the actual work practice standard enforcement. You know, we are looking for the required certification that work practice standards were met. So where we're not seeing that, we're taking those counts and making sure that folks know that you've got to document the work practice standards being met. So on the on-site inspections, conversely, I think, you know, we're doing all the things for the on-site inspection that you would expect. We're looking for those work practice standards. We're making sure that you know, everyone's trained as they're supposed to be. That there's a certified renovator is assigned or working or available. But we're also, you know, sort of doing a records check too. So I just wanted to reiterate that there's a relationship between the records inspections and the on-site inspections that's pretty close. So because we're looking for both of those, and we're looking to enforce the entire rule, which overlaps between those two types of activities. And again, all with the goal that the applicable work practice standards are being followed. So the next slide, 27 in my slide pack, is just a reiteration of a lot of what I've already said. The third bullet really goes to some of the ways that we try to use available information and available resources to better identify violations. So the use of electronic data sources in our sort of targeting approach is growing because there's so much electronic data out there. There's so many opportunities to look at building permits, code enforcement, things like that, local government data systems particularly, that we're continuing to try to forge ahead with relationships with local governments to utilize that data. In most cases, we're aligned in our desired outcome, which is to, enforce the law and reduce childhood lead exposures, as one example. I mean, so we're able to get in there and start to talk to local governments and utilize information in a way that I don't think we had been able to before. Similarly, we talk a lot to national organizations. We try to get out as often as we can. Anytime there's a national meeting here in D.C., and make sure that we're speaking to at least the trade organizations that represent the windows and doors and the contractors who might be at a job site, to explain to them what our enforcement practices have been, but to encourage folks to disclose to provide EPA information where they think that there's violations going on. And again, those tips and complaints are very valuable, and they're the most valuable when they're timely, when they're accurate and provide a lot of information about the types of violations and where they're going. And again, we take them very seriously. So that's a real powerful tool for uncovering non-compliance.
Pardon me, Greg. Jane, we're running short on time. We are going to post this on our website, this PowerPoint, so everybody's taking notes will be able to get the information.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering if you want to cut to the chase with a couple last quick messages. I think that people are especially interested in knowing enforcement outcomes.
Well, why don't we go to slide 30 then? I think that's where we're headed. In the enforcement results area, again, we're just getting over, I think, a point of establishing a pipeline. And in the enforcement world, you sort of need a pipeline of inspections that lead to a pipeline of cases in development that lead to a set of cases that are settled or complaints that are filed. So in this world, over the last 2 years, we've been able to conduct about 700 or more inspections in the RRP-led paint work practice area. So as you get up to numbers like that, you're able to start really looking at case development significantly and again starting to see some successes. One other tool that we use that I just wanted to note for folks is some regions are using, and this is not a practice that we've dictated or necessarily even encouraged at headquarters, but it can be useful where the region wants to quickly respond to a potential violation. But the inspection report or other information that they have isn't sufficient enough to really pursue a case, they'll issue a notice of noncompliance. Parties only get one of those, sort of one bite at the apple. That does also identify that party as someone who we might want to check back in with later to assure that the compliance that we didn't see last time, we see next time. So notices of noncompliance, another tool that we're issuing. There's a number of those that are out as well, and probably more in that area to come. In the civil administrative complaints area, we have one complaint that's filed right now. It's in New Jersey, and it's likely to be resolved soon. It's a case, a work practice standard violation case where, just like I'd mentioned before, there were actual work practice standards witnessed in the investigation. They were included in the complaint. There was also record-keeping violations included in that complaint as well. But the three civil administrative cases that we've settled, I want to talk about just a second. We hope to be able to have a press release out soon. I'm hoping that comes out any time now that talks about these three cases. One is in Region 2, another New Jersey case, I think, that had a both record keeping and work practice standard violations. And the Colin Wentworth case in Region 1, which many of you probably are familiar with, settled. So that case is now complete. There was a penalty paid, but that case also included both work practice and records violations in there as well. And then another case out of Region 7, the Johnson-Sachendorf case, which was a more of a traditional records-keeping violation case. But bundled together, I think, make a strong initial foray into some enforcement results and successes here. And, I think there's going to be more to come in the near future. My last slide, really slide 31, was just a sort of a pitch to, you know, how I think you guys can help. Again, I think that the role that you play is critical, and your opportunity to keep communicating the consequences of noncompliance is really important. I think that the benefits of compliance are equally important. I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons to comply that have nothing to do with whether or not an EPA is going to take an enforcement action against you. And I just wanted to reiterate, you know, that protection of children, particularly children, but everyone's health is important, and to limit their liability. Again, EPA enforcement actions, one source of potential liability, but homeowners and others are out there, and if they find out that they were illegally exposed to lead, or their family was, there's a certain amount of civil liability out there for folks as well. Homeowners are another key constituency that we're interested in making sure that they understand the lead safe work practices in their homes, why those are important. And again, keep sending tips and complaints to EPA, but just noting that, you know, the more information, the more specificity, the better our chance of following up and actually getting some violations in our inspection.
Thank you so much. We're going to roll over to questions. First, I want to make a quick introduction. Jessica Lucas, who runs our trading program and everybody on the phone knows very well, is going to jump on the line for just a sec to make a couple quick points, because we have about 15 questions in the queue, and I imagine those who have been listening avidly might add some more questions soon. We're going to go rapid fire through some questions after Jessica makes a couple quick points. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. Just to make it real quick, and we can follow up with emails afterwards, I did just want to update you that I am in the process of trying to get the information from the authorized states. I know there's been some enforcement actions on those states, so hopefully that'll be coming out to you shortly. I just wanted to mention I've also contacted 3M, and I'm trying to get some information from them, a little more specifics about the use and the approval of the new lead checks. If anyone has specific questions they want to ask me, I'm expecting a phone call back from their laboratory person. If you have specific questions you'd like me to ask them, please email them to me, and I'll make sure to include that and get everybody updated on that. We are also looking into using some of the materials that were shown to you here, trying to get NCHH's logo and information on, and hopefully get those distributed to you shortly. I am also working on one of the things mentioned earlier with the outreach is trying to get local government involved. Just to let you know, we have begun working with various cities, some in California, as well as Chicago Department of Health, which is potentially looking to make this a requirement in order to get a permit. So we want to be able to get in there and provide them assistance, as both for training as well as guidance of helping this happen. The last thing is I just want to pitch probably to our EPA individuals. Thank you very much for taking time to do this. And we would be more than happy to help in anything we could do with the home episode. We have some wonderful trainer/contractors on the line, as well as throughout our network, that would be probably more than excited to help with your initiative on this as well.
That's great. Thanks, Jessica. All right, so now we're going to turn to questions. Rebecca's going to lead us off. These are questions that have come in over the computer.
I'm going to run through these super quick, and then we can get to, I think we'll take everyone off mute, so if there are other questions that weren't raised on the computer, you can ask those. The first was from Bill Robinson. What measurable outcomes have come from the outreach that EPA has done?
Wow. Well, we have a full report on some of the outreach. We just didn't have enough time to go through it. We measure the number, we basically related it to the contractors who were trained, but we measured like the downloads of the material, the outreach material that was downloaded from our computer site. And we, if you want the specifics on the numbers, I'd be happy to provide that to you.
Maybe that's something we could send out as a follow-up email.
Okay.
That would be all right with you all.
Okay.
Here's a question. If the EPA checklist is complete, can renovators expect to pass inspection? Greg, are you still on? Can you hit *7 and answer that question?
I am here. I didn't realize the checklist was referenced. The question is if we provide some guidance on what to expect when you're inspected, whether or not that should be used to try to help pass an inspection, I would think so, yeah. I mean, whether or not there's still violations based on the fact that you've applied our checklist, I guess, as a format. We haven't really developed it yet, but if checklist is how we go, I'm hoping that people would use it, and I'm hoping that at the end of the day, we have less violations because people know what to do to be in compliance with the rule.
Okay. What's happening with a lead test for aluminum siding? Will there ever be a test kit for that?
At this time, the substrates we've tested on are the wood, ferrous metal, plaster, and drywall, and that's it. So the ferrous metal does not include aluminum. There is no specific effort on EPA's part to test it on additional substrates, but manufacturers themselves are certainly capable, and if they choose to test it on other substrates and follow the testing protocol that we've laid out previously, and they show data that it works, we'll take a look at that data and act accordingly.
Basically, that's what 3M did. The two new substrates that were just recognized with the lead check, they undertook the studies following the EPA protocol and worked with us, but it was basically their own doing to go ahead and get that recognition via the evaluation process previously outlined by EPA.
One quick question on the outreach materials. They're about 7 megabytes, big file sizes, and so one commenter asked whether they can be condensed so that they can more easily be emailed.
The files that are provided are as condensed as they can be. If they need something more directly, they can send a note to one of us and we can get it to them directly. It's very difficult to make them any smaller without losing resolution.
Okay. So the answer is to email, and you have Darlene Watford's email address up here on the screen. If you need a different format, but you lose some resolution when you get the smaller size file. Okay, one more. Phil Godshall is asking, did the ads reference home renovation projects linking the hazards of renovations with lead poisoning? So I think the question is for the ads that referencing home renovations projects, did they link the hazards of renovations with lead poisoning?
Actually, the consumer one specifically listed several reasons why you should make your home childproof your home, I believe, and it listed like 8 different reasons why, and some of them were because of lead poisoning and the risks of lead were mentioned in there. So, yes, the contractor one specifically was identifying the fact that you needed to, if you disturb more than 6 square feet of lead, then you were supposed to be certified and trained. So,
okay,
the consumer was.
The last web question is, does EPA use any method to measure and validate the effectiveness of their outreach efforts? And this is what you were referring to earlier, and you have some of the results from that evaluation effort that we share.
Yes.
Okay. We've gone through all the web questions at this point, so I'm going to turn over to Jane, who I know has a list of other questions that have come via email and other routes.
Okay. The first one is from Steve Landfield, one of our trainers. And the question is, what's your best recommendation, I think, program office, for training providers to get contractors in the seats at this point? People are having trouble filling the classes. They know a lot of people have not been trained. Any thoughts, any suggestions you would make at this point?
Off the cuff, I would think probably if you would advertise, maybe try to take advantage of the logo to sort of ride the right on the wings of our campaigns and basically reiterate some of the things that we're doing, work along with us to increase the numbers of participants in the classes, I would think would be an effective way. Use the website information. I would, if you have any kinds of opportunities to advertise, email, post it. If you have newsletters that you produce, that type of stuff would be helpful, I would think. Can you think of anything else?
Got it. Another training-related question. On what date is the Spanish language version of the training manual, the RFP training manual, going to be available? Of course, there was one, and the course has been revised, and the training manual hasn't been developed or issued in Spanish yet.
We don't have a specific date.
You don't have a specific date. Do you intend to actually produce that Spanish language training manual?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. We just don't have a date when it's going
to... Okay. Is there anything that advocates could do to help you to get that done? All right. let's see.
This may have already been answered, but people are not allowed to do the translation of the materials themselves, and will it not be considered an official EPA training course at that point? Is that the problem?
If they do translation, they need to show us that it's been done by a certified translator, by somebody who is, you know, able to do it. We need some sort of documentation that translator is.
I'm not sure if people could hear that, but so people can translate the course themselves. They have to be a certified translator. Is there actually
we haven't narrowed it down to something specific, but we need some sort of documentation to show that the person that translated it is, you know,
qualified to do
the qualified translator. Yeah.
And I think what the end sentence of that is that you have to submit then that end product as part of your accreditation.
Right.
Okay.
This usually happens when somebody applies. They have to show us the course they're going to use unless they're going to use our course. So if they're going to translate it themselves, they would give that to us when they apply for accreditation.
Right. I think NPHH would be willing to underwrite that translation if it hasn't happened. I know people have started on pieces of it. So if there are any trainers on the phone that want to partner with us on that, we're willing to help.
Yeah, and actually most of the course has been translated. It's really a matter of translating the updates.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay, so that's great. Okay, another issue. It's Ulrika again. Back to you with a couple points. First of all, we received information, NCHH received information recently with some numbers in terms of the number of inspections that have been completed by type of violation. And I just wondered if you, I'll just share the numbers with everybody on the phone, and I just wonder if you want to comment on these, Greg. We understand that there have been 125 inspections of training violations, 308 inspections of pre-renovation education inspections, and 766 inspections of work practices and certification administrative issues combined. So those are some results that have been reported to others externally by the agency. And I guess I'm just wondering, Greg, if you want to comment on that. Are those numbers low, and that's why you weren't providing them today, or any comments?
Are they low? Well, just to give you guys a background on where those came from, they were a request from Senator Inhofe about our enforcement of the RRP rule. We provided those numbers. They are not, and what's not on this page was our caveat that these are not necessarily the public numbers in ISIS. It took a certain amount by hand parsing through the inspection numbers to get to these totals. So in the last 2 years, 766 inspections on RRP, I think is a decent number. I think we're working to try to get a correspondingly high number of enforcement actions publicly completed.
All right. Thank you. And we're going to go back to the queue for some other questions. Actually, you know, I think at this point we've only got a couple minutes left, and we'll try to get back to the questions in the queue, and they'll be on the recording for those who have to hang up. We'll go over a little bit after 1 o'clock, but actually right now I would like to open up the line, and if anybody's got any questions, I'd like
the conference has been unmuted.
I'd like you to go ahead and share that. Please identify yourself when you ask your question, if you would. Thanks.
Hi, Greg. It's Jessica from NCHH. I think the previous question, and correct me if I'm wrong, whoever submitted it, regarding the checklist
I want to say that they were referring to the post-renovation checklist that's required.
Okay.
And I think from what my interpretation of the question was, is if a contractor follows the post-renovation checklist, could they be fairly assured that they would be okay with the inspection?
I mean, everything's case-specific. It's hard for me to generalize like that, but I think following a checklist and showing that that's what you did, it goes a long way to convincing an inspector or an enforcement officer that you've met the standard. So I think it's a very helpful thing to do.
Great.
Sorry, folks. Let's see. Anybody else on the line who wants to pop in here with a question?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
David Upshaw, Chicago, Illinois. Who do we contact to get information, or who can some of our contractors contact to get information regarding certified firms? We're a small municipality, and we've had a staffing issue and just in terms of the economy and things of that nature. And so we'd like to work with a contracting firm, and we've had several who have actually gone through the classes, but they are trying to be certified as a firm. And I've looked at the paperwork, and they're like, well, which one do we select, and, you know, how much do we pay? And I'm not really sure how that process works, per se.
So your question is how to get certified as a firm?
Yes. Is there a contact number for contractors to call regarding getting certified as a firm?
Yeah, EPA has an extensive website. Get Led Safe is a starting point, and it has all the instructions on how to fill out the application, which is also there. It's only a 2-page application, and it tells you where to send the check. And currently, we are certifying within 30 days.
Okay.
Hello, this is Sean McCadden. I have a question as well.
Yes, go ahead, Sean.
Yes, I had actually submitted the question in regards to the effectiveness of the outreach that EPA is doing. As opposed to just the number of places you put it, are you measuring the effectiveness to know that it's actually working or not? And if you are, what have you found out? What are you planning on doing differently so that I guess it actually works?
At this point in our phase one outreach campaign, we have not reached the point where the effectiveness has been measured.
John, this is Paula Henry. Basically, you know, we are using both in our Ed Council campaign as well as the RRP-specific professional marketing firms. And with both of those campaigns, there are certain measures and metrics that are, you know, the industry norm in the marketing industry. And we are by no means professional marketers at EPA, but we are using whatever tools is the norm in that industry to get as much information as we can along those lines. But from my vantage point anyway, effectiveness of marketing is a tricky thing generally. But we, both of our campaigns have a certain level of measuring and metric reporting.
What would the metrics be?
But again, again, this is the industry norm, is to measure placements, market value, hits to websites and downloads of banners. I mean, some of these IT tools are really what you do. It's not quite the same as, you know, doing some kind of survey before and after. We did do some of that actually with the Ad Council. However, it's not something that is included in our RRP campaign for resource reasons.
Yeah. Would it not make sense to measure actual effectiveness as opposed to quantity so that you would know it's actually working, particularly if the point is to protect children?
Yes, I would think it would. You'd have to have the before and the after, obviously, and again, just be based on that. That is a much more involved and resource-intensive kind of activity.
I would agree with that, but spending money and not knowing if it's going to be effective might actually be worse.
Has there been a correlation made between where the radio ads and the PSAs were done and the number of contractors who attended trainings in those locations?
No, we haven't done that correlation, as far as I know. I did want to mention that before we began the outreach campaign, we did conduct focus groups with a number of different groups, contractors and consumers, and that helped us to guide and lead us to develop the material that was a big influence on the materials that we developed. So just wanted to bring it.
And while there hasn't been a post-hoc correlation, the placement of ads targeted in cities known to have older housing stocks, cities that we know where there's blood lead, elevated blood lead levels, data, stuff like that. So there's a front end thought process. It's much more complicated and resource intensive to do it on the back end.
So is it that EPA doesn't have the capacity to do it?
I think we might be dealing with the resources issue. That seems to have been the theme throughout this whole 3-year experience. I'm sorry, but I just want to move on to a couple of other questions that have been asked. We're wondering if, I think these are both program office questions, if anyone would care to comment on the status of the opt-out challenge, any comments anybody wants to make about that, and also whether, what's on the horizon in terms of test kits, sort of once and for all, can you change the rule to remove the discussion about a target for false positives, or what can happen with that to take that issue off the table? So those are two questions for the program office.
On the opt-out, there was a hearing in that case late last year, so now we just wait
what
for
you
the
doing,
side. There's nothing else to be said about that.
Right. I think it's expected in June.
Yes. And then on the test kit piece again, basically there's a situation where the regulation suggests but doesn't require if the test kit's not available, our compliance test kit is not there. But nonetheless, the question is, since that was put in the rule, is there industry action on that, or should we go for a rule change to get rid of it, or what?
Have any specific actions to provide any additional incentive or such a kit, although, to our knowledge, there's nothing going on in that area. However, we certainly would pause. But we did clarify last spring that you will continue kits that can meet the phase one criteria, and that is indeed what we've done, and just most recently last week added additional substrates to one company's kit recognition.
Okay.
Ask a question?
Go ahead.
My name is Mark Pascal. My question is, are you doing anything to get small multifamily property owners on board, as well as realtors and banks who have foreclosures and they're making decisions on hiring contractors, usually without RRP in mind?
Actually, in this phase two outreach, one of our sort of top targeting audiences is sort of multifamily housing. We're trying to work with the organizations that deal with that, to educate them and to advise them. I know that we thought about banks and foreclosure. We certainly were thinking about insurance companies, so that's a good idea.
Many realtors are, urging homeowners, let us, help you out when the conveyance. So a lot of realtors are actually hiring contractors looking for the cheapest price and not RRP certified. So we're running into a lot of that.
Well, and we have historically, of course, worked with realtors because they have a certain role in the 1018 process. So certainly a renewed reminder to them that there is, of course, the pre-notification, but also RRP obligations is also a good idea.
I guess I just ask. I wonder if perhaps the agency would look at providing a toolkit or something to really, you know, direct code agencies, state and local code agencies, as to what they should do if they want to change their local law to bring this into under their purview. And then secondly, if they can't change their local law, besides calling in tips and complaints or whatever to the hotline, are there other strategic moves? Like, you know, we have produced something. I know that we've got some suggestions for code agencies, but I think something coming from the agency would be very powerful.
Thank you.
Because basically one of our other phase two ideas was to, and I mentioned working with agencies, we were looking to come up with a how-to guide for other states, seeing a model that had been successful in one of the other states that has been able to do that. So that is one of the projects that we're hoping to develop.
Okay. I don't see any more questions in the queue that haven't been answered. Anybody on the line with any final point you'd like to share, suggestion for EPA about how to make the outreach more effective?
Yeah, I would like to say something.
Yes.
This is Debbie Garrity from Armor-Clad Windows. And unfortunately, I believe that most contractors are not going to come into compliance until they see and understand the extent of the enforcement.
Right.
It's too bad. It's human nature. Do you have plans on advertising very loudly any enforcement that you've done or fines that you've levied?
This is Greg. Yes, I mean, that is definitely the way we want to highlight the enforcement outcomes is to highlight it as loudly and broadly as we can. So we'll do that here through the enforcement mechanisms, which is a press release and a release to, you know, sort of the big player, the big national organizations that we deal with regularly. But we also, you know, want to use other EPA information dissemination opportunities. So we'll work with the program office and Tala's group and others to get the word out on our enforcement successes as they, you know, as they continue to come in.
Can I ask you a question, please?
Sure.
This is Steve Landfield. I noticed that whenever I go to Home Depot in particular, they always keep the lead checks back behind the counter. They never push them, and they make sure that really they're an afterthought. Has there been anything done in that front?
I don't believe that we have actually gotten into the stores with Home Depot, but I did want to mention that another one of our ideas is for phase two, we are working hopefully with the headquarters of Home Depot to come up with some ideas, marketing ideas, and they seem to be approachable and open for that. But we could mention that.
Yeah, we haven't heard that. And then Jessica, maybe if you're about to talk to 3M, I wonder they have any insight on why that might be.
I can definitely bring it up in my conversation. I briefly spoke to the marketing people, but then they're putting me in touch with the laboratory, but I can get back in touch with the marketing.
I mean, we can check in with them too, but we can't think of a reason off the top of our head why that would be. There's nothing I can think of that's hazardous in a
I see it place after place that I go around my area in New Jersey. They are never out. You have to ask for them. They're back behind the paint counter.
David Reynolds in Mississippi with a quick one for either Darlene or Greg. I'd echo the experience with Home Depot. I also deal with a lot of smaller specialized paint retailers and wholesalers, and I'm not seeing the information either, and I'm not getting the familiarity. I always bring it up when we go in as soon as we get to be pals a little bit and we can talk. But it's simply not getting out there. I carry a lead check in the pickup just to demonstrate how it works. But somehow, if I mention RRP, usually there's kind of maybe a reluctant nod or maybe a few people have talked about it one way or the other. But that's about as far as it goes. And these guys are seeing contractors all day, every day. Just a thought. I don't know what the answer is for that one, but Lord knows that's a big target of opportunity.
This is Darlene. We did do a substantial amount of letter writing and emailing, specialized emails to small retail hardware stores back a couple of when the rule first became effective to try to reach out to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times it's not necessarily the owners of the company that face with consumers.
Sorry about that.
Is that commentary?
Oh, I can't wait for the recording of this.
Darlene, thank you on that one. I just don't know the avenue to reach these guys. I do know that they really listen to the company tech reps when they're on board. But of course, lead paint is such a done deal, long gone for them. I really don't know. Cheerleaders, maybe. I don't know.
Another aspect here is, you know, we have 10 regional offices spread around the country, and they are part of our program. And so while we in headquarters may take an approach where we hit mm-hmm. the stores and some of the big-time retailers, we are also asking them, because they are more local, to try and do, you know, the similar kind of spreading of the word, but perhaps in a more localized arena. So.
Right, we're an authorized state too, so we've been trying it through our MDEQ. And anyway, thank you.
Can someone explain? I know EPA has said that they have no authority to force local towns, states, et cetera, to include requirements of proof of firm certification on building permit applications. Can you help us understand why it is that EPA can't get that to happen to help with enforcement?
Good question.
Yeah, this is Mark Edmonds. I mean, pretty simple. The statute that creates this program doesn't give us the authority. It doesn't say anything about us doing that. The law has to give us the authority to regulate, you know, an entity like that. And we got the authority to regulate contractors, renovation companies, not towns and cities that are just permitting. You know, if the town does regulations or if city government if the city does renovations, we can, you know, regulate them as far as the work practices go. Well, we can't, you know, require them to run their permitting process a certain way just because the statute doesn't mention that.
Yeah, I know, and I think it's understood that the agency can't require action, but I don't think the statute prohibits cooperation and close collaboration. And I think that there's still room to grow. Exploring exactly how the agency and the local agency can have a partnership other than through the hotline anonymously.
We can talk to those folks, sure, but they don't want to get on board. They don't have to.
But we are, as Darlene mentioned, we are looking at Minnesota as a model, and we're going to try to pull together what Jane called a toolkit to try, you know, more of a how can you do this? And there's different degrees. I mean, Minnesota had to put into effect some rules or regulations requiring it. You know, you may not need to go even that far necessarily. You can still promote, you know, that's a place to get out. So, again, we're working. You know, Jane and I have actually had several conversations around this, so we're looking to them for some input. Also, we have the National Council of Legislatures that we're working with as well.
Is there any liability back to the states for granting permits, knowing that work is being done illegally if it's not being done by a certified firm?
No. I mean, those voters and local officials need to object to that. I mean, I do want to say I think that most public agencies have some requirement in procurement around, you know, integrity or compliance, or there's usually something to build on there, some general language about not contracting with unclean hands or, I don't know, I think that that's something else we could probably add to this guidance. Is suggestions of the kind of statutory language already on the books in many places. Other thoughts? Follow up on that? Jessica, did you have any wrap-up you wanted to offer?
Just to let everyone know that this really is the first step in our marketing plan at NCHH. So we are, you know, we welcome any ideas that you have that you'd like to see coming from us. We've talked to a bunch of you about what you guys would like to see, but we want to make sure that we try to help fill those seats that you're asking, that you want. We all want so desperately to get filled. So any recommendations would be appreciated.
Great.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody who's participated and hung in 21 minutes into the next hour after we were going to be finished. I want to thank everybody who participated from EPA. We were really glad to offer this dialogue to everybody involved, and we'd be willing to have another one in the future if anybody would care to have us do that. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.